inflation is much too high, and we understand the hardship it is causing, and we're moving expeditiously to bring it back down. The economy and the country have been through a lot over the past 2 years and have proved resilient. It is essential that we bring inflation down if we are to have a sustained period of strong labor market conditions that benefit all. The current picture is plain to see. The labor market is extremely tight and inflation is much too high.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell announced a hike in interest rate last week. The half percentage point boost is meant to slow rising inflation, which is at its highest it's been in the last 40 years. Powell has not ruled out more hikes to the interest rate. Well, the stock market didn't really like that. It responded with a huge single day drop. And that's prompted fears that a recession is perhaps looming. Joining us to talk about this is former Planet Money host Jacob Goldstein, now host of the business and tech podcast, What's Your Problem? Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay. Are we or are we not headed toward a recession?
Nobody knows. The real answer to that is nobody knows, but it seems totally plausible. How about that?
Nobody knows. Of course, nobody can predict the future.
Of course, nobody knows.
Entirely accurately.
I think so, but what do I know? But I think
so. So what are the indicators that we could be headed toward a recession?
Well, the most important one, I think, is inflation. Inflation is really quite extraordinarily high right now. And it has been high for a while, right? As I'm sure you'll recall, you know, last year, inflation went up a lot. And there was this really hope at the time, and a reasonable hope, that it would be, well, transitory. That was the word the Fed was using, transitory, a passing thing, right? It was just, oh, no, it's like reopening is super janky and the supply chain isn't back in shape yet. So this will just pass by once everything is up and running. And now that it's been inflation's been high for quite a while, it is seeming less transitory. The Fed has, in fact, stopped using that word and started raising interest rates, which is the traditional thing the Fed does to fight inflation. And that raising interest rates is supposed to cool the economy. It's supposed to slow the growth of the economy. But it's very hard for the Fed to get that just right. And quite often, they raise interest rates so much that it drives the economy into a recession.
So it really has to hit a sweet spot. But I guess, can you explain it for those of us who aren't great with Econ 101? How does raising interest rates cool the economy and perhaps lower inflation? And then how does raising it too much do the opposite?
Sure. So if we just start by thinking about the inflation itself, right? I mean, you said Econ 101, let's say supply and demand, right? It doesn't get more Econ 101 than that. You get inflation when there is too much demand relative to supply, right? And right now we have both a lot of demand and some problems with supply, right? We have a lot of demand because, well, unemployment is extraordinarily low. That is a happy fact that people don't talk about that much right now, but it's great in a way that unemployment is really low. Almost anybody who wants a job can get a job. Wages are going up, but that means that consumers have a lot of money in their pocket and they're spending it. They're going out and buying stuff. That's demand. The other side is supply. Supply is okay. You know, people talk about supply chain problems. In fact, we're buying more stuff than we were before the pandemic, but supply can't grow fast enough to keep up with all this demand. You have these additional problems like lockdowns in China that hurts supply. Factory output there is harmed by that. You have the war in Ukraine, obviously a horrible tragedy in many ways, but it has this economic effect of reducing the supply of oil to the world, reducing the supply of wheat. Ukraine's a big exporter of wheat. So as a result of all of this, we have a lot of demand right now and not as much supply as we like. And so we have a lot of inflation. So the Fed can't do anything about supply. They can't get more wheat or get more oil, but the Fed can manage demand, right? So they raise interest rates. And what that does is it makes it more expensive to borrow money. And so consumers are less likely to go out and, you know, buy a car, right? Car is a classic thing. Prices have been going up, both because a lot of demand, limited supply. It also means businesses are going to be less aggressive about borrowing money to expand, to hire more workers. So the higher interest rates are, the less people are going to want to go out and buy more stuff.
But how does that affect our necessities? Like, we still need to go buy groceries, and they're very expensive now, or relatively more expensive than they've been in many a year.
That's true. So, you know, it affects it at the margin, right? It doesn't mean people are going to buy less food. It might mean people go out to eat less. You know, one important thing is prices aren't going to go down Almost certainly. I mean, gas prices will go down. The price of oil kind of does its own thing and is super volatile, and that'll fall. But overall, the price level, right, the sort of price of the basket of stuff that a typical person buys, that's probably not going to fall. Like, that's called deflation. That actually messes up the economy in a whole bunch of other ways. So what the Fed wants to do is slow the rise in prices by, you know, making people less eager to buy stuff, basically. And one effect that that has, I mean, even if there's not a recession, it's plausible that we'll stop adding jobs, right? Like, their dream version, I think, is like some growth, but less growth than now. Adding some jobs, but not as many as now. The really hard thing, and the thing the Fed very often gets wrong, just because it's hard, is slowing growth without actually causing the economy to shrink, without actually causing us to lose jobs. That's when you go into a recession. And that's what, you know, very often there was this study by Larry Summers, a prominent economist, who looked back at the economy since the 50s and found that every time inflation was as high as it is now and unemployment was as low as it is now, there's been a recession within a couple of years. It's just a very hard move to get from where we are now to where we want to be without a recession.
Of course, the last recession in 2008 was disastrous for many people. A lot of people lost their jobs. Is he forecasting that? Or others forecasting?
No. And in fact, there was a brief recession in 2020, a sort of technical, you know, beginning of the pandemic recession. Those two, the 2020 recession and the 2008 recession, are sort of extremes, you know, and neither is a normal recession. You know, we have to go back to 2000 to find a kind of normal, like, it's bad, but it's not like devastation across the economy kind of recession. I don't know the future, but the 2008 recession was accompanied by a massive financial crisis, to state the obvious. And a massive financial crisis makes things really devastating in a way that a typical recession that you get just because the Fed is raising interest rates to cool inflation is just not that bad. It is bad. To be clear, it's bad, but it's not 2008 bad.
But we are seeing a bad scenario right now in Hollywood and in tech stocks. So, for instance, Netflix is not doing well at all and laying off a bunch of people. Is that something that could ripple out? Like, if a lot of other streamers do the same thing and then advertising slows down, and that could be a bad thing, well, not just for our business, but for the media in general.
That's an interesting question. You know, making an ad-supported podcast, it makes me a little nervous. One thing to think about with stock prices, and in particular with tech stock prices, is just how much they've gone up. The rise in the whole stock market, and especially in tech stocks, just over the last 2 years, just since the start of the pandemic, is wild. Like, they went crazy. And so they are falling now, but in the medium term, they're still way up. And I don't think that alone will cause a recession.
Okay. But you do think there will be a recession on the way?
I mean, will is a strong word. It would be unsurprising if there were a recession. There's this classic, basically, joke about this kind of forecasting where you're supposed to say there's a 40% chance so that, you know, if the thing happens, you can say, see, I said there was a 40% chance of it happening. And then if it doesn't happen, you can say, see, I said it probably wasn't going to happen. Like, nobody knows if there's going to be a recession.
Oh, my gosh. It is called the dismal science for a reason.
Yes.
Jacob Goldstein, host of the podcast What's Your Problem? And author of the book Money, The True Story of a Made-Up Thing. Jacob, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, how smartphone data could be used to prosecute women seeking abortions in states that outlaw the procedure if Roe v. Wade is overturned. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We rely on smartphones for almost everything these days, from navigation to shopping, banking, and some people even use it to track their periods. A lot of that data, though, is not private. Now, should the Supreme Court allow states to outlaw abortion, privacy experts are warning that authorities in the states that do so could use internet and phone data against people who try to get an abortion. Joining us to talk about this is Danielle Keats-Citrin. She's a law professor at the University of Virginia School of Law and author of the forthcoming book, The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us is Jeffrey Fowler, tech columnist at The Washington Post, where he's been writing about this. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Well, let's begin with you. You write that a smartphone can know if someone is seeking an abortion, even if they don't tell anyone, like friends or family, if they don't text anybody. What information does a phone have that can reveal this?
Phones know so much about what's going on in our lives, so much so that we don't really even think about it necessarily anymore. But of course, phones can record your communications, which includes who you called, when you called them. It can record the text messages you sent back and forth. It can record the histories of what you've been searching for, both in, you know, on Google or on Maps. It also frequently records body health data. A lot of people use apps now to track the reproductive cycle. And that's all information that's either stored on the phone or sent off to companies via apps and other services that might store that data. And the thing to remember is that that anytime a company has data about you, they can get an order from a judge to say, hand over some of that data.
And also, they can track where you've been if you have your location services on.
That's another big one. Yeah, if you have your location turned on, for example, to use Maps or to use a service like Uber, those companies get to know your location. But even more sort of insidious is there's a lot of other apps out there that you don't think of as collecting your location, maybe a flashlight app or you name it. But there's a whole industry out there that's based on them taking that information and then selling it to data brokers. So there's all these companies you've never heard of that might have information about where you're going.
But isn't that data anonymized? Like, it doesn't say you, Jeffrey Fowler, are going here and there and you searched for this and that. It's anonymized, right? It's just a data point.
It depends. So, for example, a company like Google, when it collects information about your location, it is associated with your account. And, you know, they can and do frequently get asked to hand over that information to authorities. In theory, they're not associating your name with it, but there may be other identifiers in there that could be used to track you down. For example, phones have these hidden ad IDs on them that most people don't know about or don't know to turn off. That could be one way to track you down. Another way is if they know where you were before you went someplace and then where you went after. That's a pretty good indication of who you might be if somebody's really interested in figuring out who you are.
And has that ever happened?
Yes. In fact, last week, shortly after we got the leak of the proposed ruling from the Supreme Court, some journalists at Vice's Motherboard blog spent $160, and they bought a week's worth of data from a location data broker company called SafeGraph that showed where people who visited more than 600 different Planned Parenthood clinics came from and then where they went afterwards. So that's already been done.
Danielle, so law enforcement uses this, and we've seen how they've used it for other purposes, such as investigating the January 6th insurrectionists. So would that be any different in the case of someone seeking an abortion in a state where seeking an abortion becomes illegal?
It's not going to be any different. So, you know, from the perspective of legal protections, if a court has a subpoena and orders that information, it's going to be turned over to law enforcement. And there's something called the third party doctrine, which under the Fourth Amendment means that you don't have a Fourth Amendment right to be protected against information that's shared with third parties, and whether that's information that your app shares, your location, information that you store and share on your health apps, your period tracking, fertility apps, dating apps, inevitably that is sold and shared with third parties, including data brokers. And so all of that can just simply be either sold to law enforcement or turned over with a subpoena. And you can't object and say you violated my constitutional rights.
But we have seen cases where cell phone makers like Apple, for example, have refused to turn over the information that law enforcement sought in a case against a suspect.
Yes, we have. And it's certainly laudable, right? So companies can so choose to protect their customers' privacy, and particularly with Apple, it's sort of their brand. That not that they necessarily protect our privacy in all aspects, but they're really a hardware company, right? And so they choose to, you know, vigorously protect information that is shared and stored on their devices and will stand up for customers. But so many other companies, like, their business is the sale of our data.
But isn't health information protected under federal HIPAA laws?
Unfortunately, you know, HIPAA is an insurance portability law. It's got like a sidecar of privacy protections, but those protections only cover a really narrow band of actors, and that's healthcare providers. So your doctor, the hospital, your insurance company, it does not cover the fertility tracking app that you use, the health band, not at all.
Let's talk about the fertility tracking app. And a lot of women use these, and a lot of women use them to track their periods. Why are they particularly porous, if you will, to data collection?
Right. So, you know, in the United States, 1/3 of women and girls use some form of health app, and that includes, you know, period tracking apps. And they ask for a tremendous amount of what I call intimate information. So information about your bodies, your health, who you're having sex with, when you've had your period, if you've missed a period, what your physical symptoms are, your cramps, right? And you might say, okay, Danielle, surely they have in their privacy policies protections that say, we're not going to share your information with third parties. So many do, unfortunately. Like, if you, first of all, we don't have time to read all these privacy policies, but if we did, you would find that a lot of period tracking apps are sharing intimate information with third parties.
So can you foresee a scenario where, let's say in Louisiana, let's say Louisiana outlaws all abortions, which they're threatening to do, that they could actually subpoena the data from these period trackers to look and see if a woman has skipped her period and also then geolocate her to a Planned Parenthood office in another state and then found that her periods resumed and made the connection that she got an abortion? Do you foresee that as being a possible scenario? And then prosecuting her for that.
Sure. And let's just, to make it easy on jurisdictional questions, let's just, if it's okay, change your hypothetical so that a woman goes to a doctor, you know, her OBGYN in her own state, and then her period tracking app says that she missed a period and then got her period again, right? So that information could be used against both the doctor and the woman for procuring a termination of a pregnancy. And it's, I have to say, just, you know, intimate privacy ought to be understood as a fundamental right, as a civil right. And it's often pretty costly for women and minorities. And I think here we're going to see the, you know, period tracking apps being used against women and their providers for prosecutions. And, you know, of course, I think the result will be the chilling of, you know, people using fertility tracking apps for fear that, you know, this can be used against me as evidence in a court of law. And I would imagine we're going to see the chilling of, you know, searches. That is so much intellectual activity, so much of our, you know, exploration and use of these important, I think, tools, we're going to just see a whole lot less of, because they can be weaponized, you know, against us and providers.
So someone, an attorney general or a DA, could conceivably say, well, you searched for Planned Parenthood clinics and that is evidence against you.
Yes. And your period, let's just couple it with some evidence that your period tracking app says that you, you know, you had a period, you missed your period, then you got your period again 2 weeks after you saw that provider. I fear that's, those sorts of scenarios are precisely, I think, what we're facing. You know, as a law professor and a civil rights advocate, it's sort of like an impending doom scenario. And I think we've got to act now to protect the privacy of our intimate information at a federal level.
So there are no federal laws that would protect someone in this situation?
No, we don't have a comprehensive federal data protection law at all.
And the Fourth Amendment doesn't
help? That doesn't help, totally. It doesn't help us either. because of something called the, you know, the third party doctrine, which says that if you mm-hmm. share information with third party businesses, whether it's a bank, this is like early cases, or your telephone records, you've got no privacy interest in that information. But we've seen no cases that involve, you know, specifically subpoenaing a, you know, fertility tracking app for a person's searches and fertility information. You know, there's no reason to think that this court is going to protect it and say, hey, that's an exception to the third party doctrine. At least I worry that it won't.
Okay, Jeffrey, so let's talk about how women or anyone seeking an abortion, even providers, could protect themselves if they're afraid that their private data might be used against them. What are some ways to protect your privacy online?
Yeah, just to echo something y'all were just talking about, this is a reminder that civil rights are digital rights now. They're one and the same. And our lack of privacy rights in the U.S. at a federal level are reflected in these kinds of concerns. So one thing you can do is when you write to your members of Congress to your concern about abortion rights, also talk about privacy rights, because the two are linked together. On a more technical, kind of like practical level, there is technology you can use to try to obscure what you're looking at, what you're looking up. You know, don't, when you're Google searching things, well, maybe don't use Google. Maybe use a search engine like DuckDuckGo. When you are on the web, you can use a VPN or virtual private network, which would obscure a little bit your location and who you might be, so that you can search a little bit more privately. When you're having direct communications with friends or others about looking for a doctor or going to seek a procedure, use an encrypted service such as Signal or WhatsApp. Also, you really might want to think twice about collecting your fertility data in a period tracking app. You know, if you find that information useful, you can also kind of make a spreadsheet and keep it on your local computer if you want, or password protect it. And then, of course, if you're going to a doctor's office, turn off location services on your phone before you go. That way you are not collecting that data trail.
Right. And then, so I guess, Danielle, so that's for the individual person, but what if you are a provider? How can you ensure your privacy if other people are using their cell phones to get to you?
Right. Our privacy is everyone's privacy. You know, privacy is a social value. And so you're right that if your patients aren't not protecting their own privacy, it implicates the doctor's privacy. And, you know, providers can be subpoenaed, you know, their business records, as much as it's protected by HIPAA, not in the face of a court order. And so, unfortunately, the privacy that I sort of want for myself and I don't have implicates the privacy that doctors want for themselves and unfortunately now will not have.
Danielle Keats-Citrin is a law professor at the University of Virginia School of Law and author of the forthcoming book, The Fight for Privacy, Protecting Dignity, Identity, and Love in the Digital Age. And Jeffrey Fowler is tech columnist at The Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up, a closer look at exactly what states are ready to do if Roe v. Wade falls.
States are not only going to try and ban abortion, but they're going to try and criminalize it and potentially affect the choices we can make with respect to contraception.
Jessica Levinson, our Legal Eagle, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Just 2 days after the leak of the Supreme Court's draft opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade, a Louisiana State House committee took up a bill from Republican Representative Danny McCormack that would make abortion a homicide.
The taking of a life is murder, and it is illegal. Louisiana law currently fails to provide equal protection for human life. Persons are deemed unworthy of legal protection for no other reason than that they are not yet born.
McCormack then turned to his right and introduced an evangelical Baptist pastor named Brian Gunter, saying, quote, "It's more his bill than mine."
Now, I know we have a trigger law. It says that if Roe's overturned, abortion will be fined $1,000 to the abortionist if he commits an abortion. That is woefully insufficient.
This bill would also grant constitutional rights, quote, "from the moment of fertilization." It'll be heard by the full Louisiana House later this week, and we're going to talk about this bill and how overturning Roe could motivate state legislatures to pass even stricter anti-abortion and even anti-contraception laws with Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our legal eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so this law, as it has been introduced, even if Roe falls, would it be legal or would it face a lot of challenges?
I think it would face a lot of challenges for some obvious reasons and for some less obvious reasons. The obvious reasons being, I don't think that there is a good legal basis to define a embryo or to define the moment of fertilization as leading to a person that is protected under the 14th Amendment, which is part of what they're trying to argue here. And then the less obvious reasons I think that this bill would face a lot of problems is that it completely upends our separation of powers. There's a portion of this bill that would allow states to just ignore federal court rulings that contradict the new law. That's not how our legal system is set up at all. And it would even say that the legislature has the ability to impeach and remove state judges that try and block the law from going into effect. That also is a separation of powers issue on the state level. So we have supremacy clause issues, we have separation of powers issues within the state. And then we have the problem of more of the substance of the law. And so, yes, I think this faces a lot of challenges.
Right. So there's a line in this proposed law that says that they would enforce the law without, quote, regard to the opinions and judgments of the Supreme Court of the United States. So basically saying what? That this law, the state could just ignore any Supreme Court ruling that they don't like?
That's how I read it, which, again, is not how our system of government is set up. In which, let's think about, if that were the case, it would mean that states could ignore Brown versus Board of Education. It would mean that states could ignore other conservative rulings like Citizens United. I mean, there's a reason that we talk so much and fight so much about who's on the Supreme Court, because they're the ones who make the final decision as to what the federal Constitution means. And if the Constitution, the federal law, is in conflict with a state law, we know what happens. There's so many gray areas in the law. This is not one of them that means that the federal law trumps. That is the supremacy clause. That's preemption. I think it's predictable that red states are trying to go past just outlawing abortion and say we're going to criminalize abortion, even if it goes into certain uses of contraception. What I did not predict is that states would try and completely upend our system of government. That to me is the really surprising part of the story, actually.
And yet when you look at the Texas law, which basically outlaws abortions after 6 weeks, that directly contradicts Supreme Court precedent with Roe and Casey. So it's not like there isn't precedent for ignoring Supreme Court precedent.
I think that is absolutely the case. Although it's not, I would say that the court has basically allowed Texas to pass a law that violates Roe and Casey, or not basically, the court has, through silence and through affirmative action. But as I understand it, the Texas law doesn't have a line in the actual state law that says it doesn't matter what the Supreme Court says. We're on our own here. The states can ignore the highest court in the land. And so, yes, it is absolutely true that states are now going beyond what Roe and Casey would allow, because we know where the Supreme Court's going, but that's still different from saying, and going forward, you can go ahead and ignore the Supreme Court.
So, as we mentioned, this bill grants constitutional rights to a fetus, basically from the moment of fertilization. And I want to play a clip from that House hearing in Louisiana from an opponent of the bill. This is a woman named Sarah Omojla. And she says this bill would criminalize the IVF treatment that she recently underwent.
Not every embryo and not every fertilized egg can be brought to term. So they have to be tested. And so to test an embryo, cells are taken from it and tested. And this bill would allow my doctor and I to be prosecuted for battery for this standard medical practice.
So is she right about that? If this law is passed, that could happen?
So with the caveat that, of course, I'm not a medical expert, I would say taken to the logical conclusion that if you do, in fact, define an embryo as a person with all the rights that come along with that, then yes, that makes some sense. We've certainly seen critics say this is not just about abortion. It's also about forms of contraception like IUDs. It's about emergency contraception like Plan B. And it could also, as we just heard, impact in vitro fertilization, IVF. So I think what's important for people to remember is that as these laws get more aggressive, again, we're not just talking about surgical abortions. You and I have had conversations about what this would mean for on air about abortion pills that could be provided by the federal government. And it's going to keep going further and further. And these laws will move into, I think, the realms of contraception, like Plan B, like IUDs.
So forms of contraception that may be considered a form of abortion. But most IUDs, that's not considered a form of abortion because it's not dealing with an already fertilized egg.
Yes, exactly. So there's a lot of case law, or I should say there's a lot of arguments that we've seen in the past, for instance, cases dealing like with Hobby Lobby, which we've talked about, mm-hmm. where we're having a discussion about what type of contraception is truly contraception and what type of contraception is abortion-like. And I think, again, without any medical background, I think that's the conversation we're going to increasingly be having.
Okay, changing topics, we are going to talk about another application of the 14th Amendment. This one involves another section that says no one will be able to hold federal office if they've, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States. And there have been a pair of legal challenges to Representatives Madison Cawthorn and Marjorie Taylor Greene trying to keep them off the ballot this fall because of their roles in January 6th. So tell us why the judge ruled in favor of Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Well, what the judge said here is basically she engaged in a lot of behavior which we might not applaud, but we can't say that this falls within the 14th Amendment. We can't draw a close enough line between her revving up a crowd and saying, yes, let's go say that this election was stolen. Let's go, you know, protest at the Capitol. That we can't draw enough of a line between that and either engaging in an insurrection or rebellion or supporting an insurrection or rebellion in the way that we need that type of direct support. Again, this is part of the 14th Amendment that was meant to say that people who fought in the Civil War for the Confederacy could not, in fact, be members of Congress. This is not a provision that we've used since. And I think the court signaled throughout the hearing, throughout the administrative hearing, that yes, we might have had a lot of political advocacy here, but we can't create a strong enough line between what she said and what she did and the type of more direct, long-term planning, intimate relationship with the people who did, in fact, storm the Capitol that we would need here.
Jessica Levinson teaches at Loyola Law School. She joins us each Monday here on Press Play. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why the Spice Girls should be appreciated for empowering young girls and inspiring a lot of today's female recording artists. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and now for a little dose of girl power. Yo, tell me what I want, what I really, really want. So tell me what you Yes, the Spice Girls, Ginger, Sporty, Posh, Baby, and Scary. The five Brits ruled the late 90s and remain the most successful girl group of all time. They sold 85 million records worldwide. They were beloved by a generation of young fans with their messages of girl power, individuality, the importance of friendship. Critics at the time mostly wrote them off as untalented and wannabes, a group manufactured by the pop music industry to push an empty version of feminism in a cynical bid to sell records. But now, more than 25 years after their debut, the Spice Girls have endured, and that's the subject of a recent story in the New York Times about them. Joining us now are the authors, Alisha Haridasani Gupta. She covers gender for the New York Times. Welcome, Alisha.
Thank you for having me.
And Jennifer Harlan, editor at the Times. Welcome to you, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for having us. We're thrilled to be here.
Great to have you both. Okay, so are you both Spice Girls fans? And which one's your favorite, Jennifer?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think like a lot of members of my generation, I really grew up listening to and loving the Spice Girls. Spice World was actually the first album that I ever owned. So I identified the most with Baby as a kid. I think I was a little more of a shy kid growing up. So I liked that she was a little more reserved, but still very cool and still part of this very cool, cool group.
Okay, Alisha.
I also am a Spice Girls fan, and I mostly related with Posh Spice, again, because she was not as loud as the others, and that was kind of my personality growing up. I was always a little bit of an introvert, but, you know, what is so fascinating about the Spice Girls is that I grew up in Hong Kong, and the fact that I and Jen both have the same level of appreciation for them. This is pre-internet. That just says mm-hmm. something about how big they were.
And how old were you both at the time?
I was 6 when their first album, Spice, came out in 1996.
So no wonder you liked Baby Spice.
Yeah. So it was there. I mean, it was really my first experience of this kind of message of girl power and this kind of like pop music and the first band that I really, really fell in love with. And they were these sort of larger than life figures in my life, but also somehow felt very approachable in a way that a lot of figures in pop culture and in the media don't when you're a kid.
And Alisha, were you around the same age?
Yeah, I was 7. And yeah,
boy, do I feel old.
No, it was the same thing because, you know, I also was making dances at school. And again, the fact that it was so global, it just blows my mind.
Right. So were you two the target demographic? That seems awfully young.
Well, I think the target demographic initially when the Spice Girls came about was sort of girls and women writ large. But I think it sort of took the band by surprise a little bit just how young their fans were. But from very early on in the band's career, they started seeing young fans really being drawn to their message, showing up at concerts with their parents or grandparents even and events. And I think it was something about this very accessible message about being with your friends, being who you are, embracing your individual personality, and also the kind of over the top theatrics a bit of who they were, the personas that they really leaned into, the fun sort of theatrics of their videos and their concerts. It was all very accessible to a much younger demographic that maybe hadn't been drawn into pop music before that.
Mm-hmm. How did they get their personalities? Like, how did they get their names?
The Spice Girls were manufactured. There was an ad placed in the paper to create a girl band. And this was the Herberts. They created this group and moved them into a house and paid for their singing lessons, their dance lessons, their media training, all of it. But very quickly, these girls realized that they were not happy with the vision that the Herberts had for them.
Which the Herberts are a father and son team.
Yes, exactly. And the Herberts had a very old-fashioned view that the girl band would have a lead singer and backup singers, and then they would have like the same costumes or the same kind of aesthetic. They would look similar. And these girls realized that that is just not who they were. And they didn't want to have a lead singer. They wanted to be equals. And so they decided to make a run for it.
They broke out of prison.
literally
essentially
got into
yeah,
a car, they left.
Wow.
They really stood by the vision that they wanted to be themselves in a group. So, you know, fast forward a few months, there was already enough buzz in the industry that they had created by doing the showcase that they were in the unique position of auditioning managers. You know, that is a complete turning of tables. Like, that never happens for them to be holding the cards like that.
Hmm. So they really wrote all of their songs together. They divided up the lines singing wise in the song so that there wasn't one lead singer that emerged, and they each had their distinct personalities that all, and it was sort of an important part of the girl power message too, this idea that all the people in your friend group, you don't necessarily all dress the same and all have the exact same interests and the exact same personality. You're friends with different people who have different interests. And so they were sort of modeling that in a way in the group, in a way that made a lot of sense to them, even though they were being told by people in the music industry, well, that won't work. That's not the way things are done. But to mm-hmm. them, it seemed like, well, why wouldn't we do it this way? This is who we are.
But what about the names? Scary Spice, Baby Spice, Sporty Ginger, Posh?
So those nicknames were actually imposed on them by a journalist who met them and said, wow, okay, this one has a little baby personality, so I'm just going to call her that. And this one is a little bit scary. And, you know, she's loud and she's talking, you know, she's very opinionated. I'm going to call her Scary. Ginger, I'm going to call Ginger. Like, and it just stuck. And the beauty of what the Spice Girls did by embracing those nicknames is that they essentially defanged the potential harmful impact of those nicknames, right? They said, you know what, we'll take it. They are very tongue-in-cheek, and they just took it.
It was sort of like emblematic of the way that they approached everything. Like, if you watch interviews with them at the time, they're always kind of getting ahead of the joke and embracing. They knew in advance mm-hmm. the kind of criticism that was going to be leveled at them, because it had been leveled at a lot of pop groups before, and particularly at women in pop culture and in pop music. And so one young woman navigating the music industry and this newfound fame on their own, like, that's a really intimidating prospect. But when you have five women who are doing this together and presenting this really united front, it made them feel pretty unstoppable.
Yeah. And I'll just add, you know, if you go back and watch their interviews, like, say, for example, their interview with Jay Leno is incredible, because you'll see just how much they dominate the conversation. They do not let Jay Leno speak. You know, they're on there, they take up space, they're five boisterous, you know, laughing, giggling girls, and they completely lean into that brand. And, you know, they make the jokes themselves. So in that interview, Sporty Spice says to Jay Leno, you know, I'll crack a joke, I'll tell you a joke. What do you call a Spice Girl with two brain cells?
Two brain cells, I don't know what.
Pregnant. Having brains and glamour at the same time.
Everyone starts laughing and the girls take over the conversation. It is very chaotic.
And Jay Leno is not someone who is usually at a loss for words, and also was someone who had no shortage of jokes about women and pop culture at the time. But if they make the jokes about themselves, then no one else has the power to take those digs at them.
All right. Well, speaking of Sporty, we have a song featuring her, and let's hear a little bit of it and then talk to you about your interview with Sporty Spice, aka Melanie Chisholm. Come on and do it.
Keep your legs shut, get back in your place. Blameless, shameless, damsel in disgrace. Who cares what they say? Because rules are for breaking. I said, who made them anyway? You've got to show what you feel, don't hide. Come on and do it.
So catchy. I can see why your 6 and 7 year old selves love that.
Even sitting here now, I can't. If you could see me, it's radio, but I'm dancing along with my in front of my son. I know. You just can't help it.
It's so good. So that's the Spice Girls song, Do It. You spoke to Sporty Spice about that. And what did she have to say about that? And just looking back at her career with the Spice Girls.
I think one of the things that really stuck out from our conversation with her is that, you know, she said at the time, they were so young. They were running around like crazy. I mean, they put out their first two albums and the movie and toured the world in the span of just a few years and created this huge cultural impact that we're still talking about. But it was in a very intense time. And so it's really only now, 25 to 30 years later, that we're looking back that they have started to have a sense of what that legacy has been like. And they knew at the time, like they would see young girls and people from the LGBTQ community showing up at their concerts and saying how much they've been inspired, but seeing how that impact has endured and really empowered a generation, that including a lot of people in the music industry, that was one thing that she said has been particularly inspiring, is getting to meet people like Adele and Sam Smith and Charlie XCX, who are making really exciting music today and at the top of the industry, and who have spoken both to Melanie and to the rest of the girls and also in public about just how impactful the band was on them as the first thing that really inspired them to think like, hey, I could do this as a young girl or a young queer person growing up.
So why is it that at the time they were written off as just, you know, a bunch of airheady girls who were performing feminism just to make, you know, just to make money, just to sell records? The critics didn't take them seriously at all.
Yeah. So if we cast our minds back to Britain of the early 1990s, it was mainly boy bands and also Brit pop groups. So it's kind of guitar forward boy bands. And the thinking at the time, boys will like boy bands and girls will like boy bands because they will have crushes on those boys, but no one will like a girl band. So there was just no real example of a girl band dominating Britain, first of all. And then globally at the time, well, over in America, there was the punk riot girl movement. There was the start of the Lilith Fair. And those two movements were still fringe, but they were very specific about their demands for women's rights and the women's movement, right? And so mm-hmm. for them to see a pop creation come in and dominate the conversation about girl power and women's rights, they were worried that it was being commercialized and cheapening the message of the women's movement. And the editors of the British newspaper, The Guardian, decided to send Kathy Acker, who is an activist, she's a punk rock feminist writer, mm-hmm. to interview the band. And the idea was, oh, let's put this like genuine feminist up against these phony feminists and see, you know, maybe there'll be a takedown. Maybe it will be a harsh article about the Spice Girls. And, you know, she herself expressed a little bit of skepticism going in. She says, you know, what is this nonsense, in an unpublished version of her essay. But after meeting them, she realized that she actually loves them and that they have joy and friendship. And, you know, being maybe unacademic about girl power is important also to the feminist movement, right? So what she was saying is these women are not coming from like the academic circles, they're not like politically organizing, but they're still an important voice that we should listen to.
And I think that's really clear when you look at their legacy today too, that how many women or people today will say like their first encounter with feminism or with girl power and this idea of empowerment came through the Spice Girls.
Yeah, 6-year-olds aren't reading Simone de Beauvoir.
No.
All right. Well, here's to girl power and women power.
Absolutely.
I know. Yeah.
Rock on. Thank you both for coming on today.
Thank you for having us.
We're always thrilled to talk about the Spice Girls. So thanks for having us on.
Jennifer Harlan and Alicia Haridasani-Gupta. Their article in the New York Times is called Reconsidering the Spice Girls, How Manufactured Girl Power Became Real. Last time. does it for Press Play. And before we go, I just want to remind you that this is our spring pledge drive, and we are asking for your support. And we're just keeping it really brief for now. We're asking for a donation today. And what do you think? Do you think you could support what you hear on not only Press Play, but all of KCRW, the music and all the cultural programmings, the national news, the international news, all of it is here for you. Whenever you turn on the radio or fire up your app, we are here for you. So we're asking you to be here for us just a couple times a year. And this is one of them, 800-600-5279 or kcrw.com/give. kcrw.com/give. Lots of great thank you gifts there to check out. So do it now. Don't delay and become one of our Spice Girls. Yes. All right. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.